Bullying's changed a lot since Kurzweil's time. For one thing, he didn't have to deal with cyberbullying. Kids now have the technology to bully other kids outside of school, on evenings and weekends. As many as 25% of teenagers have been the victims of cyberbullying, according to one study. And those teens are most likely to say they've thought of suicide. Emily Bazelon has spent a lot of time studying cyberbullying. She's the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Charles Monroe Cain sat down to talk with her.
I remember it being like, it's a physical thing. Some kid, normally a boy, would like, you know, punch you or, you know, yeah, take your money. And then it kind of transformed a little bit. But now my kids are like, well, if somebody hits you, that's not a big deal, my son said. I said, what is a big deal? I said, well, if somebody emails you something mean because other people can read it and it really hurts your feelings. And they're much more aware of that kind of bullying. And it's really a big deal. I would say 4 or 5 times this year, there were bullying little conferences at school where all the school would meet to get a little anti-bullying pencil, and it was all about words. Is that what you're talking about, that we've transformed to, kind of evolved to bullying being words and not being physical?
I think that's right. I mean, it's important to remember that words can have pretty devastating psychological consequences.
Yeah.
And so if you think about bullying as harassment, whether it's verbal or physical, that continues over time and involves a power imbalance, that's one way of limiting what we're talking about and limiting the kind of behavior involved in bullying to what kids have described as finding the most upsetting. And then you can see that, yeah, words are a way in which to have power over someone over a long period of time, or, you know, a period of time, in a way that can really, really get to them.
What do you say to my mom and dad, or your mom and dad, who are like, ah, come on, that's not bullying, you know, that's just, you know, kids need to toughen up. I mean, geez, just some mean words. That generation above us does not get the level of what cyberbullying and what it means. How do you argue with those folks?
Well, I think when you talk to kids about their experiences of cyberbullying, if they've been a victim of it, it's clear what's so hard about it, right? First of all, it feels very 24/7 to them. So when I was in 8th grade and having just like a miserable time of it and feeling like a victim of bullying, I would go home at the end of the day and I had a break, and I didn't have this awareness hanging over me. The kids could still be talking about me, still writing mean stuff that would then be permanent and visible to anyone who looked at it on the internet. That can really have a kind of psychologically corrosive effect on kids. That's quite damaging. And I don't think that, you know, blowing it off and telling kids to toughen up is really gonna, you know, help them address those issues.
Do kids see this as real? Like, I know, and maybe because they're younger, they do, but, you know, I think people don't see the internet as real as the real world. So, like, hey, I can call her this or call him that on the internet because it isn't really real. But I think you argue that it's more real, right?
Well, it's funny. It's both, I think. So I think sometimes kids who are drawn into bullying online, because of the distancing, because they're not looking another person in the face, they forget that it's real. And they sometimes try on a kind of meaner, strutting persona that they would probably never do in person. So one thing that I found really worrisome when I was working on my book were posts saying to a kid, you know, one kid saying to another kid, why don't you just go kill yourself?
Wow.
It's really hard, right? Like, that's awful.
You would never say that on the playground. Or maybe you would, but I doubt if you'd say that on the playground, right?
I think that's right. I think you would never say that in person to someone's face. But if you can say it anonymously online, somehow I think you're right. You forget that those words still can have an impact. But the person receiving the message, it can feel all too real, right? Because they have this feeling that often anyone can read the names they've been called, the insults being hurled at them. There's no way to control the audience. It's not ephemeral. It's not like the spoken word where it happens, it's over. You can go back and keep obsessing about it and looking at it, and you have to decide whether to respond or not over a period of time. All of those things, again, can have really tricky, complicated psychological consequences for some kids.
Well, let's be specific. I would assume probably the most commonplace, and it certainly is for my life and for young people, is on Facebook. And Facebook does stay in some ways forever. Is cyberbullying, there must be a serious issue for Facebook.
It is an issue for Facebook, and also even more important for kids right now, Instagram, which Facebook owns, and Snapchat, separate company, because Instagram and Snapchat are where kids do more of their socializing. And most of these sites have rules against harassment. Some of them go as far as saying things like offensive speech. But then there's the problem of enforcement. There are just so many millions of posts and bytes of information zinging along these sites. What really happens if you report it? What do the site see as bullying and harassment as opposed to how you experience it? And what do we want from these places? Are they places that we want to think of as having these private enforcers, essentially like a speech code? Or do we want them to not really be exercising control?
I'm wondering, you know, if I put the F word on Facebook, it could be very likely I get an issue back from a person from Facebook telling me, hey, you can't do that, or they, you know, block your post. Do they do the same for bullying or that kind of language? That must be much trickier. You know, an algorithm can figure out if you're swearing, but it's hard to know if you're being mean or not.
Right. Well, that's certainly what the sites have claimed. They have said it's hard for us to come up with an algorithm. There are so many subjective connotations that go into how people experience words. It's just too hard for us to figure out in advance. We need people to report to us what bullying is, and then we'll judge it. And so that's the sort of trade-off that these sites have been making. And I think the consumers have not really, you know, en masse demanded all that much enforcement from Facebook or Twitter or Instagram.
My understanding is that if you say, Emily, if you say something about me on Facebook that I don't like, I can report you. And if I report you, there's a team, and that team comes to me. And I mean, isn't that how it works? But that could be almost, I could see that being abused as well.
Well, right. So then that team has to decide. And when I was reporting my book a couple years ago, they were making very split-second decisions about what counted as bullying and harassment and what didn't. And then they had to decide what the consequence was going to be. And all of this was happening very, very quickly. And with millions of different users in different countries, if Facebook really took this seriously, it would take a lot of manpower to really address it. And so Facebook was trying instead to create automated responses that would encourage kids to go find someone in their community to go and help with this and talk about it and hopefully work out the conflict. And, you know, you can see the reason for that. Those people are going to know the context. They're going to have some understanding. And then you can also see why it's in Facebook's self-interest not to have to really step in and mediate all of these different conflicts. That's Facebook would have to spend a lot of money if it was really going to undertake that role.
Well, it seems like probably the most, not easiest, but the simplest way to prevent bullying is to not have it start in the first place. And that would be with what you write about, which is empathy. How can we help create empathy among our children?
Right. So let's think about the word empathy for a little bit. We use it to talk about caring about other people. And I think that's really the key. It's not just that you can feel someone else's feelings. It's that you actually care about how they're feeling. And you're not using your sense of their experience to manipulate them. You're using it to try to help them in some way. So once you start thinking about empathy in that way, I think that turning to stories, to books, to movies, to videos, to try to have kids feel empathy for characters who are different from them but aren't in their real lives, that can be a really excellent place to start. It just like sort of displaces the whole anxiety around this a little if you're not asking kids to focus in on their own world and their own social lives. And often kids who can seem pretty mean, if you give them a book in which there's a really vulnerable character, you can get them to talk about that kid's vulnerabilities and how they might be able to help. And hopefully some of that thinking will then translate, perhaps unknowingly, into their own lives.
Emily Bazelon is the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane.